This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. For those of you that were at Connie's talk yesterday, I'm going to make what was referred to in China as the Great Leap Forward. I'm going to skip over some sections because when I had talked to Mike about what portion of the Genjo Koan I might like to talk about, I was kind of drawn to the section about the fish swimming in the water and the bird in the air, which means we're going to bypass a few sections, but there are three more speakers coming after me, so there may be some backing up to do. But be that as it may, for those of you that were with us this morning for our morning service, this is actually exactly where we picked up in terms of what we chanted during the service, right where I'm going to begin. So for those of you that were at the service, I was going to begin by reading the section that I'm going to be talking about this afternoon. So you'll get to hear it for a second time. And for those of you that weren't with us this morning, you'll get to hear it for the first time. When a fish swims in water, in the swimming there is no end to water. When a bird flies in the sky, in the flying there is no end to sky. This is because from the beginning they are in accord with the water or the sky. With extensive activity comes extensive use, and with modest activity, less use. Yet essentially and everywhere, the full use is made of all that is functioning, and all that is functioning turns and moves freely. Leaving the water or leaving the sky would immediately be the leaving of life. For with the fish, water is life. And for the bird, sky is life. Also, for the sky, the bird is life. For the water, the fish is life. Life is bird and sky. Life is fish and water. It is the same with practice, with realization, and with everything in life's duration. Like the bird and fish, we must first manifest in our element before extending further. We will not find our way or place. There is just the arrival at this place. Everyday activity is the manifestation of absolute reality. The way is everyday activity actualizing everything. So, try and talk about all of that in the course of the next close to an hour, roughly an hour, and we'll see how that goes. A lot packed in there, obviously. And maybe a good way to start, if Nico could pull up the graphic that I had with you to pop up. All right, just to start, at a deep level, but in a light vein combined. So I'll give you a moment to take this in, and we'll connect it with what we're going to be talking about.
Thank you.
So, this seeking for the meaning of life, what is real? You know, what's this all about? And, you know, we talked about how when one side is illuminated, when the other side is dark, this is the darkness. You know, what is the reality behind our appearance, the appearances that we meet with? This could be it. This is actually considered to be an official cosmological explanation behind the universe these days. So this really could be it. And I find its explanatory power to be pretty compelling. So I'm on board with it. And I think the programmer is actually Scott Adams, the one who programmed this universe. So this is his way of directly communicating with us from time to time. That's why I always read a strip every day to see what words of wisdom he has to impart to us. But the power for me about the practice, about Genjo Koan, about the realized universe, actualizing the fundamental point, is that even if this is the metaphysical reality behind it all, this is what I would still be doing. I'd want to be here sitting with everybody, doing this practice with everybody. So this, for me, and this is an important point, I think, contained within Genjo Koan, is that it's not dependent upon some metaphysical reality. To put it another way, to reference another early teaching of Dogen's, Fukan Zazengi, that's the universal recommendation for the practice of Zazen. Universal means in our day and age, you know, it goes a little beyond what Dogen probably intended, but I think it's still in line with it. It means that regardless of which multiverse you are in and what the reality is behind it, Fukan Zazengi is still applicable. It truly is universal in that vast sense. So when I read Genjo Koan and when I study it and dive into it, it's one of the powerful things that strikes me about it and about this practice is that that even if some of these shocking possibilities for what's really going on wouldn't matter. This is the way for me. It's not dependent upon any other, you know, behind the scenes, whatever it is that's dark that we don't see, that's not clearly illuminated, except for these messages from Scott Adams. So, the first, before I come back to part one, I've actually taken this segment of Genjo Koan and divided it down into four smaller pieces. So we'll be able to get a little organization to how we tackle it. But first, there was just a real brief passage from Shahaku's excellent study of Genjo Koan titled Realizing Genjo Koan that kind of, I think, sets the stage for this whole thing. So I wanted to share with that with you at this point. And that is where he indicates to us that the analogy of fish and birds is about our Zazen practice, which along with day-to-day activities based on it are connected to the entire universe. So it's important to realize that this is just kind of a sequel to Fukan Zazengi in that respect. It's definitely not a PBS nature program narrated by David Attenborough about fish and birds. It's about us. It's about studying self, as he talked about earlier in Genjo Koan. To study birds and fish is to study the self. And to study the self is to practice Zazen and all of our other everyday activities. They're no different. And when we do that, we come to clearly understand their connection to the entire universe. Or another way of looking at that is it's actually the universe practicing through us. Whatever the universe is, maybe it is a computer programmer, but whatever it is, it's practicing through us. And there's that intimate connection, connectivity. And we're going to look at this in a little while, a little further, take a deeper dive into notions of connectivity. Being with, as another contemporary thinker calls it. But we'll hold off on that just for the moment. So as Shahaku describes it then, he says, our Zazen forms the foundation of our attitude toward our entire lives. Hopefully, you have that sense of it. It's what makes this practice transformational, that it does completely shift our attitude about our entire lives through this process of letting go and opening ourselves up. Or when I put that piece of Shahaku's down, I added my own personal note to it. Continually opening like a flower each morning to realize the day. Which I think is kind of a nice way to see the practice as well. So we retire for the evening. It's kind of like the flower closing up. It's time to rest. Then morning rolls around and we open back up again. And practice resumes. And we truly are opened back up, receiving the teachings of all beings, which is how we practice Genjo Koan. So the next part, I'll reread that section since it's so short. When a fish swims in water, in the swimming there is no end to water. When a bird flies in the sky, in the flying there is no end to sky. This is because from the beginning they are in accord with the water or the sky. So the water or the sky are not something external to the self, to the fish, to the bird, which is the way we typically think of it, the external world. That the bird is flying through the air. That there's an intimate connection there, that the two are actually one. Just as is true for the fish in the water. And it's true for us in the myriad realms that we travel through. innumerable realms. And these realms interact as well. Just to begin with the two realms that that Dogen sets forth here, air and water. They clearly interact. One of the main results of that, the meteorologists are very familiar with. And during hurricane season, we hear a lot about it. So it's not like air and water even are these separate containers, which contain separate beings, birds, fish, seaweed. The list could go on indefinitely. They're all these creative forces coming together. And when a creative force impacts the quality of the water, and in fact, it impacts the quality of the fish. And same with the air and the bird. So there is no separation here, although we can speak of, and I'm going to use a term a little later on, I'll just introduce here and we'll dig into that a little deeper later. This contemporary thinker calls it a singularity, because it's not an entity. You know, he's fully on board with this sense of constant creation. But yet within that constant flow of creativity, there are, you know, there's movement. And for movement to take place, it's got to be from this place to that point, point to point. So we can designate these things. And we can talk of fish as being separate from water. And it's important in some respects that we do that. But it's also important that we recognize that fundamentally they're not different. Nothing is. So there's this sense of being and plurality, which is the singularities coming together, being with. And it's that being with where all the creativity arises, the communication. But all this is predicated on the understanding that the water and sky are not some sort of separate environment. And nothing constitutes a separate environment. Before going on, I'd like to just take a moment or two to talk about some of these other realms that we occupy, that are kind of uniquely human, but yet clearly also impact the entire planet. One of these is the economic realm. And throughout all of these realms, there's an aspect of circulation in the air, in the water, in the economy. Of course, the circulating medium in the economy is money. And the statement that money is the root of all evil really misstates the truth of the matter. Money is not the root of all evil. Greed is the root of all evil. Money is just the mechanism for distributing resources. So money can be a vehicle for great good, a vehicle for helping others, if one is motivated by compassion, by loving kindness, rather than greed. But money is a very important circulator within the economic realm. And that realm exists to distribute resources so people can use them. Pure and simple. Politics, power. The wise exercise of power. Like Mike there at Jokoji. And then there's the not so wise exercise that we're all too familiar with these days. But power in and of itself is not the root of all evil either. But it can be. It can be. It's how do we relate to these? So if we're practicing and if we relate to these because of the practice, out of this sense of being with, of our connectedness, chances are we're going to use things like money and power in skillful, helpful ways where they can actually be of benefit to all beings. And then given your location there in the shadow of Silicon Valley, guess I shouldn't leave out information. This is the information age, the age of big data. That's circulating faster than any of the other circulating factors. That's the big realm these days, is the information about all of us. And the growing realms of information. So the fact that I know that Genjo Koan has teachings that we can bring to bear in these aspects of our life today, now. It's really, in some respects, very similar to the bird in the air and the fish in the water. We're individuals occupying these economic, political, and big data realms today. So the practice I find very helpful, the teachings of Genjo Koan, I find helpful. And I hope that some of that can come out as we look a little bit deeper into this. So this fact, as we looked at before, that there's no separate external world. So there's no separation in the case of the fish, no separation between the fish and the water, no separation between the bird and the air. And bottom line is, as we live our lives, the entire universe is living with us in the most intimate type of connection. So when a fish is swimming, the whole body of water is swimming. Now, Crooked River Zen Center, on Thursday nights, we've started studying another work of Dogen's, the Mountains and Waters Sutra. And he has a line in there about mountains walking, which this passage perhaps help shed some light on that one. If when a fish is swimming, the whole body of water is swimming, then when Dogen is walking through the mountain is walking. And to bring it back to our practice of Zazen, again, when we sit and let go of our discriminating thoughts, we become one with the universe. So we get it, we realize it, we manifest it. That's what Dogen referred to as the realization of the Buddha Dharma. So let's move on to part two. With extensive activity comes extensive use, and with modest activity, less use. Yet essentially and everywhere, the full use is made of all that is functioning, and all that is functioning turns and moves freely. So taking this notion of realms and relating our activity to those, you know, for me, this is my second year in retirement, so talking about the economic realm, my use of the economic realm has dropped down quite a bit, which has been very pleasant for me. I've enjoyed that, because my use is much less than it once was. Yet, essentially and everywhere, the full use is made of all that is functioning, and all that is functioning turns and moves freely. So even though I'm using it less, the impact is still as widespread as ever. It's just less. But I'm certainly not a fish out of water, so to speak. So in connection with this section, I can now introduce that modern thinker I've been referencing. His name is Jean-Luc Nancy, being kind of a fan of the various Star Trek series. Anybody with the name Jean-Luc is going to get my serious attention and consideration. So he was very worthy of that attention, because it also helped the fact that he was influenced by philosophers I knew and held in high regard. And the more I thought about the more I looked into his writings, I realized, you know, I was a philosophy major in college, but through the practice, I'd kind of gotten away from that. But every once in a while, something will pull me back in. And that was such a thing. And I guess it's appropriate, just a sidebar note here, that I should be using this book in conjunction with a talk on Dogen, because when I got it out and I started going through it, there was a receipt in there. I was clearly using as a bookmark back in the day, and it's from February 11th of 2007, and it's from my favorite bookstore in the world, City Lights Bookstore. I bought two books that day: Being Singular Plural by Jean-Luc Nancy. And then the other book I got was by Heejin Kim, hot off the presses at that time, Dogen on Meditation and Thinking, a Reflection on His View of Zen. So I bought the two thinkers in the same purchase, and now here I am pulling them back together again. But it's Nancy who has really taken this notion of being with and established our connectedness as constituting the essence of who we are, the essence of our very existence, as he puts it. Without the with, there's no existence. Basic teachings of interdependence. We only exist because of our intimate connections. The individual, as such, is a fantasy. It's a fabrication. It's a myth. It cannot exist. It's impossible. Yet, as I indicated, we need to have an accounting for that in terms of its role in the process of continual creation. And that's where he uses the term singular and plural as an adjunct to that. And plural for him is not just an assemblage of singulars, of I's constituting a we. The we is already part of the singular. So singular, plural, and being, which is kind of like shunyata, it's the absolute, they're all intertwined. You can't pull one out from the other. They're just different ways of seeing reality, which is what this practice is about. It's seeing reality, being in accord with reality, and seeing how we are already in accord with reality. Because that art thou. So Nancy uses the term circulation, but he equates that, kind of almost synonymous with it, is eternity. That circulation, because there's no bounded aspect to it, circulation is boundless. So it's also eternal. And it goes in all directions, but it moves only insofar as it goes from one point to another, which I was describing earlier. So that's how we experience the motion of things. And so the spacing, both in space and time, is what creates existence for us. It's how we exist in the world. And this existence, as he puts it, is in its very principle, very essence, it's singular and plural. We come together as individuals, as singularities, but we practice as a community. And we offer homage to the ancestors. So the community is in our presence right now, and the ancestors is this temporal connectedness. And in that sense, they're also with us right now. So that brings us to part three. Back to the language of Genjo Koan. Leaving the water or leaving the sky would immediately be the leaving of life. For with the fish, water is life. And for the bird, sky is life. Also, for the sky, the bird is life. For the water, the fish is life. Life is bird and sky. Life is fish and water. It is the same with practice, with realization, and with everything in life's duration. So essentially, I mean, what Dogen is saying is this universal creative life force is running through all things. With his talk about how life is the bird, life is the fish, water is life, sky is life. And it's the same with our practice, with our realization. It's connectedness to everything. So we don't typically think about our practice in the same vein as a fish in the water. But it's exactly right. In fact, the Sunday morning talk I did at Jokoji a couple of months ago, talking about at this very moment, God was pointing in that direction with just a single talk, so I couldn't fully develop it. But it's basically this notion that in this very moment, the absolute is impacting each and everything, the fish in the water, in our practice, our realization. There's nothing that falls outside of it. And just to track back to the previous section, which introduced the term functioning, which has come up a few times in the earlier talks. Zenki, his complete total functioning, is pointing to that very essential aspect of the universe, of Zenki, the total functioning that creates each moment. Each moment being a new creation, a new origin, so to speak. And one point Nancy makes that I think is relevant, even though it's kind of implied more than expressly stated by Dogen, is that the world does not have a final fulfillment, what we call a teleology. There's some end purpose that we're all moving towards, which many spiritual traditions, religions have. Nor, as he puts it, which puts him at odds with just about every tradition other than Buddhism, nor is there an absolute point of origin. Rather, there's a plurality of origins, this singular plural coming together, which means creation is flowering all around us. And that too, I spoke about in my talk about at this very moment, God is, where I introduced a faculty member at the time of the Harvard Divinity School, Gordon Kaufman, who wrote a book entitled In the Beginning, Creativity. Rather than creator, a supreme being who created the world, there's just creativity. And it's an ongoing process, never ending. So this plurality of origins and the creation of the world in each singularity, in so-called individuals, if we use that term carefully, is a point of origin. All of us, all beings out there. So the universe, in this view, comes alive. Creativity is everywhere. It's flowing through all things, quite literally. As Dogen says, there are worlds there in all directions. Even beneath our feet, everywhere. There are myriad worlds of creativity. There are worlds also within us. Or even in one drop of water. So that actually gets us to part four, the last of the parts I've divided it into. Like the bird and fish, we must first manifest in our element before extending further, or we will not find our way or place. There is just the arrival at this place. Everyday activity is the manifestation of absolute reality. The way is everyday activity actualizing everything. That's essentially what I've been describing. So this is kind of, that's why this section could almost be yanked out and used as a separate study text. It's so self-complete to my mind. This is kind of the concluding section that ties the whole thing together. We must manifest in our element before extending further. To manifest is to be with full awareness, recognition, realization, so that we are mindfully awake to each creative moment that we enter and exit along with all other beings. All of being is in touch with all of being. Circulation and eternity that I described earlier from Nancy. All of being is in touch with all of being. And contact as intimacy rather than as with other. Whereas Nancy puts it, which I like, it's a singularity taking refuge in its affirmation of being, of the absolute. Of God, of Shunyata, whatever term you want to throw at it, of Buddha nature. A singularity taking refuge in its affirmation of being. And one way of experiencing that kind of affirmation, there was a 15th century Indian poet and mystic, Kabir, who first talked about an image that that we're familiar with, the drop slipping into the ocean. But he subsequently amended this to the ocean slipping into the drop. Kind of shifts the whole thing. Kind of like this singularity finding refuge in its affirmation of being, because being has entered into that singularity, was actually always there. Just a couple other things I'd like to share with you, and then we'll open it up for comments, questions. Since I brought Heejin Kim's book into this, I figured, well, I'm kind of duty bound to bring something of his into my talk, which wasn't hard to do, actually. Speaking about this notion of the individual, the singularity, he says, each and every individual is light. A unique light at that. In other words, each being is originally an individuated light. And the importance of the plural for light. And here's where I compared it to a pretty profound experience I had about 50 years ago. I was able to pay a visit to Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, where they offer you the opportunity to experience complete, total darkness. And there's nothing quite like it. We've all experienced the dark, of course. But when you're down, however many hundreds of feet under the surface of the ground, maybe thousands of feet, I forget. And all of a sudden, the artificial lighting they had on in there when they hit the switch, it's jolt. Everything. So if you'd had a light to shine with into just empty space, no object to reflect it, you wouldn't see it. We only see these other singularities that the light reflects from, like us. And this sense of being a light, how that enters into this picture of individuals and singularities. So that could be taken further and run with the whole notion of communication, the way the kind of nuts and bolts of being with, the various ways that communication takes place, so that we can practice with others, come together, practice a schedule together. A schedule is a pretty key part of communication when you're doing a sesshin. It allows us to all come together at the agreed upon time. I could have my talk ready to go at the agreed upon time on the agreed upon day. Without that communication, it'd be chaos. But there isn't. Even though there's a lot of ill will out there, it's communication. It's just not coming from such a good place. But we can have an impact there, I think. That's where our practice can be very helpful. That's an impact that needs to take place. So that's actually, in wrapping up, I guess I'll just say that for me, I'm going to be spending time with Nancy going forward and just diving more deeply into the moral, virtuous side of the three baskets of our practice, virtue, meditation, and prajna, because I think our world today, I've become convinced, needs, in fact, I reference Fukanza Zengi, which is what Dogen set forth as his kind of foundation. I think our day needs Fukan Kaigi, Kai being precepts from Jukai, that needs to be the foundation for us to survive, maybe. We need to find a way of being with, of being able to become intimate with one another. Because once you do that, it's pretty hard to walk away from. People have experiences, things go on in their life that knocks them off of that. It's the greatest gift we can give to the world. So for the Crooked River folks, get prepared. In 2021, you'll be hearing a lot more about Fukan Kaigi, and a lot of my creativity and study will be going into that vein. And from there, trying to find out how we can best take our practice into the world. So with that, I'll shut up and welcome your comments. Thank you. Nick?
Thanks for your talk. I have a question about how to manifest when practicing Zazen alone. It seems to me that in community, practicing with others in the Zendo, especially in an intense way like Sesshin, it's easier to drop one's boundary of what one is and what others are, and to actually sit in a way in which one is intimate with others, in which sometimes that distinction can dissolve, and that can be a very sustaining experience for one's practice. Since the quarantine and shelter in place of the pandemic, I think most of us have been separated from our sanghas in ways that I find challenging. And I wonder if you have any advice or thoughts about how to sustain the feeling of practicing with sangha when we're actually sitting at home surrounded by an environment which only seems to assert our own individuality.
Oh, thank yeah. Well, I was wondering that same thing to some extent entering into this Sesshin, because Crooked River has been able to maintain virtually the same schedule we normally do throughout the pandemic. On Zoom, of course, we're not coming together other than the four guys down in Southern Ohio who rented an Airbnb. So that's one way of accomplishing what you're talking about. Do what they do, form that sangha bubble among the four of them. But Zoom, and I was skeptical going in. I mean, I'm not a high-tech guy, and I really felt that being with other people was critical. But being open-minded about it, and our first usage of Zoom was actually for a weekend session. Thursday night, all day Friday, all day Saturday, half day Sunday. That was our get acquainted with Zoom. And it went smashingly. So after that, it's like, I think this might work. I think we will be okay. Little realizing that 6 months later, we're nowhere near the end of this, and we're going to be doing it throughout the winter, I'm fairly certain. But it's really come to work well for us. And, you know, there have been, I don't know, 12 to 15 different Crooked River Zen Center members who have been participants in some aspect of this session here so far. So we've kind of adapted in that fashion. It doesn't replace sitting together. But the other part of the answer I'll give you to that is by when we practice together, if we practice in silence and maintain the silence, that's actually kind of a way of it prepares us for things like Zoom, I think. And my favorite example from my own experience with that was when I did a 3-week practice period at San Francisco City Center, and sat the whole 3 weeks, sat next to this woman, and there were four of us staying over to catch a flight out the next morning. She was one of them. So we got together, went out and had a nice dinner. And as we got to talking, it was so weird. We both commented that we hadn't said a word to each other that whole time, even though we're sitting next to each other. But we felt that connection that had formed. So once we did start talking, it just seemed like we were old friends. It was the most beautiful thing. So the way that we can be present with others, and I have to say, Crooked River Zen Center, I mean, we've got some incredible people with big, big hearts. So even on Zoom, you know, I think we feel a real connection with one another. It's not the ideal. It's not as good as being together, but there are ways to you know, keep that line of communication open and to be able to at least see each other. And we've gotten, frankly, we've gotten used to it as well. But, and we've had with Keith there from our Southern contingent, he kind of oversees Zoom and things like that for us. And he's done a superb job of it. So the technical side we've got down, and everybody's come together and supports it. And also recognizes that it allows people to join us that otherwise wouldn't be able to, because of distance or family situations, that they can't just walk out the door as freely as some others can. So just kind of that heart connectedness in whatever fashion you can establish it at this time.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Dean, for the talk. My question is like I'm here sitting doing zazen, practicing, and then one day I might realize the oneness or no separation. But when I think of my loved ones, especially my kids, right, this will have their life and suffering that they have to go through. And it feels to me that all my practice doesn't really help them other than making me available or being present to them. Than that, they still have their journey to take on. Like it kind of feels selfish, the practice, right? And it also like when I think of my loved ones, any of my family or my kids, right? Like they, I'm not able to do anything to their suffering. So can you talk about this?
Well, Yeah, I mean, the thing about feeling selfish, I guess to start there, because it connects directly with the comments I was making about being with, and we always are. So in that sense, being selfish is always kind of a fabrication. We can take care of ourselves, but actually when we take care of ourselves, we're doing that for the benefit of all beings too. So to call that selfish is, you know, the practice to insofar as a practice about being with. Then when you come home, you can really be with them. And quite often, you know, I know from my own experience and for others that have shared their stories with me, that they notice a big difference when they do go home because of their ability to be with. And, you know, they'll have kids that say, you know, we like when you go to those things, Dad. It's really good. Keep doing it. We fully support your practice. So I just encourage you to look at it that way and don't just see it as being a selfish act, because it's not. It's not. If you really take that practice home with you, it's a benefit to them too.
But does it, like, they still have to go through their process, right? Their life and their suffering. And I'm trying to understand, how does this help? Like, once I awaken, like, they still have their journey to do. Is that right?
Right, right. And that's, I mean, everybody has that. That's part of our lives, the fact that there is suffering, you know, the first noble truth. So it's, how can we be present with suffering? And for you, it, relative to their suffering, it's being able to be with them, be open to their suffering, be a ready ear to listen to what they have to share, and be able to bring compassion to bear. You're not going to be able to solve all their problems. I mean, I've gone through that with my own daughter, who's got significant problems. I wish I could just wave my Dharma wand and make them all better. I can't. But so there is that aspect to reality too, that we have to simply be able to be present with suffering, ours and others, and be there. And then whatever response it calls for varies from time to time, from person to person, and that's part of what you bring to that encounter. How can you be helpful? There's no boilerplate answer to that, but I think the practice does help put us in a place where we can be responsive, because we're open to what we're hearing, and we're hearing from this big mind place, if you will, so that we're kind of getting the whole big picture rather than just the more limited, narrow view about what's happening and how bad it is and so on and so forth. And sometimes we can just put ourselves in a position where we're adding to that person's angst and suffering. But to be able to just be a presence for them. Be a presence for them. I wish I could tell you something that would allow you to solve all their afflictions, cure them all. But unfortunately, anybody who's peddling that, I would turn away. I think they're selling you a bill of goods. But and then you can find support from your Sangha too to help you get through those challenging times. I know I did. I've had challenging family times, and my teacher and Sangha helped me come through. So get the help you need and then help them. But help them without as we've talked about in Cleveland here, not trying to control an outcome to make everything better. Just bring your wholehearted loving kindness and compassion, and they can see it's there. They know you care deeply for them. And that goes a long way. It's not quite the magic wand, but it's a nice salve to be able to put on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.